You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio. Each week, host Barbara Bernstein talks with local, regional, and national experts, activists, and policymakers about climate change, river protection, the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, salmon restoration, forest management, and all the other things that are critical to protect our planet. That's every Monday at 10 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. The song I just opened with is Carlos Santana and John Lee Hooker singing about the healing power of the blues. Today, we're going to focus on healing and healers by taking a closer look at the ongoing COVID pandemic from a few different angles. We'll start with a discussion about so-called medical populism and the ambiguities of how it has played out over the past few years, as well as during an earlier public health crisis in this country, the polio epidemic. We'll follow up with excerpts from an article which investigates the sources of COVID disinformation and whose interests are served by the spread of disinformation. We'll end our show today with a remembrance of a South African nurse and traditional healer with ties to Portland, who died a wholly unnecessary death from COVID, a death that illustrates the very real perils of racial capitalism. Before we get rolling, I'd like to remind you that KBOO is a listener-supported and volunteer-powered radio that gives voice to many different communities within the larger community of Portland. If you can, please help keep KBOO alive by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button. Or you can text KBOO to 44321. The KBOO community thanks you for your ongoing support. One of the greatest challenges of the COVID pandemic has been the proliferation of disinformation, which often rises up out of legitimate grievances. It has the potential both to promote rightful challenges to elite medical institutions and to spread faulty information that is harmful to the public health. Sometimes, though, ideas that emerge from alternative approaches to health that find favor within the popular imagination are real contributions to the project of healing. Norm Diamond and I discuss the concept of medical populism and what we might learn from it.
This is Norm Diamond. I'm here this morning with Patricia Kohlberg to discuss a really interesting phenomenon that's been given a recent name. The phenomenon is both historical and contemporary. Patricia Kohlberg, our guest in this particular conversation is uniquely qualified both as an historian and as a practicing physician. She's the author of, well, of numerous articles and a couple of books, one of which is a memoir of her own practice on the ragged edge of medicine, doctoring among the dispossessed. For 20 years, she was medical director for Multnomah County here in Oregon. The phenomenon we're going to talk about has been given the recent name, although it's a long phenomenon, a recent name of medical populism. I do not like the term, I have to say that right off the bat. What is it people mean by medical populism? And with that as a greeting, welcome.
Thank you, Norm. Medical populism is a, or so-called medical populism is a phenomenon that's long been recognized almost exclusively in the context of public health emergencies, by which I mean times when there's been an outbreak of some horrible disease and there's really an existential threat to the public health, and there usually are a lot of unknowns. People don't understand what the disease is or how it's transmitted. They don't understand what the outcomes are going to be. It may be killing off a lot of people.
And by people don't understand, you mean not only the population in general, but there's not yet a scientific understanding.
Exactly. Like at the start of the COVID epidemic, when we didn't know what was causing it, we didn't know how it was transmitted, we didn't know what the short-term or long-term outcomes were going to be, although we did observe that it was killing people. So there's tremendous amount of fear and uncertainty, and those create conditions for the uprising of, it's really right-wing demagoguery, which then presents certain kind of disinformation, very often for a profit motive, but usually to create political divisions and for political gains.
So to be clear, by medical populism, we're not talking about some kind of an uprising among healthcare professionals. We're talking about popular or would-be popular movements around healthcare issues.
Right. And it's very often and us versus them. It's very often, the common people who are being threatened by the inaction or the faulty moves of an elite, which is not sufficiently protecting their interests in the context of this whatever public emergency is going on. In this case, we're talking about COVID, and in a minute, we're going to get to polio.
Ah, historical example as well as contemporary. We're living the one right now. How has this played out in COVID?
Well, the thing that I want to point out in the context of this conversation is how much disinformation very quickly became a part of the COVID epidemic. You had, for example, a number of people who denied that there was an epidemic at all, that it was all a scheme of the Democratic Party. You had people who later became anti-vaxxers, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and claimed that the vaccines killed people, or that they would make you infertile, or they would change your DNA. Or there was a tremendous proliferation of these false and often dangerous cures, like bloggers or these really kind of modern day snake oil salespeople who are suggesting, oh, you should drink bleach, or you should take this horse dewormer called ivermectin. And none of these things worked. But you saw a tremendous proliferation, and most of that was used to create political divisions among people and to challenge what these right-wing demagogues would see as a liberal elite or a scientific elite that wasn't protecting their health.
I've got a doctor who's a neighbor down the street, and he risks being physically attacked when he diagnoses a patient, even now with COVID. People don't believe that it exists. what you're suggesting is this isn't an individual phenomenon, that this is part of a movement that could even characterize as political.
Yeah, to characterize it as a movement, it probably overstates the degree to which it's organized. I have a very interesting article that I'm going to read excerpts from following our discussion, which talks a lot more about where disinformation comes from, who's behind it, who profits from it, because that's a big part of it.
So before we get then, before we shift gears actually to polio and recognize that this is a repeated phenomenon, not just something we've encountered with COVID, but in other instances and historically, a regular recurring kind of phenomenon. Say a little bit more about this new characterization, what people mean by medical populism.
I'm actually going to read you a definition that I found that was coined in 2019. This is in the academic world, but this was picked up by a whole host of people who were writing about the phenomenon of populist revolt in the context of public health emergencies. And the definition that was put out there was that so-called medical populism was a political style that constructs antagonistic relations between the people whose lives have been put at risk by the establishment in the context of health crises. And I have a lot of problems with that definition.
I see some already.
Well, I think to reduce medical populism to a so-called style ignores the conditions under which it flourishes. It also erases any kind of actual contribution that sometimes medical populism can make in terms of what they're putting forward.
It's simply negative.
Yeah, and in the literature, both in the lay and in the mainstream press, what you see is that medical populism is consistently portrayed as an unmitigated evil. It causes problems, it sows divisions, it appeals to prejudice and fear, and it never... I ran into one academic researcher who just stated outright that, you know, these therapies that medical populists come up with never have any merit. And I have problems with that too.
In other words, the message behind that definition is leave everything to the experts.
Exactly. And the antidote, in fact, to medical populism that a lot of people put out there is to reestablish what I would call technocratic hegemony. In other words, to appeal to rationality, to put your scientists out there. And of course, we saw how well that worked in the context of the COVID crisis.
And in the context of polio, actually. You've written about this, and so I'm really interested to hear in depth how this phenomenon that's being called medical populism, how that played out in the case of polio. And from what you've just said, I want to hear about the positive contributions of kind of popular resistance to technocratic elite in the case of polio.
The polio epidemic had a lot of similarities to COVID. For a much longer period of time, of course, polio was a mystery. For example, people didn't know what caused it. They didn't know how it was transmitted. There were no cures for it. There weren't even good treatments to prevent the crippling. So like it was in the infancy of COVID, there were a tremendous number of unknowns. And the polio epidemic created a great deal of fear because it was a disease that primarily struck children. And it caused severe crippling. It didn't necessarily kill. And in fact, the really big killers of kids during the time of polio were probably TB and accidents. But polio did, in a way, did something worse because it crippled. A lot of people are much more fearful about that kind of outcome than death itself. It was a little bit unlike the COVID epidemic because at the time the COVID pandemic started, scientific medicine, particularly in the U.S., had established itself as a hegemonic entity. Every other alternative kind of healing practice really takes place on the margins in contemporary U.S. society.
And this is your background we're talking about.
Exactly. And that wasn't exactly the same during the 30s and 40s when the polio epidemics really took off in this country. At that time, U.S. medicine was just establishing itself as the medical scientific authority in the world of health care. It had spent a couple of decades very actively repressing any alternative forms of therapy. And this included things like this fellow who postulated this disease that had to do with faulty electrical impulses that could only be diagnosed by his machine called a dynamizer and could only be cured with his spondylotherapy. And if you paid him a bunch of money, you could get diagnosed and get cured. This is a snake oil salesman. So establishment medicine, the AMA in particular, was very busy getting rid of those people and suppressing them. But at the same time, they suppressed midwifery, homeopathy, naturopathy, chiropractic, herbal medicine, all sorts of other alternative medicines that did have things to offer. So in that sense, the medical establishment was not as well established in 1940 when something very interesting happened. And that was the arrival on U.S. soil of this woman called Sister Kenny, who was from Australia. She had a background in bush nursing, which meant that she, as a young woman, had cared for families in the bush and had done virtually everything for them because there were no doctors there. So she was doing the births, she was setting the bones, she was taking care of their diseases, whatever. She had no formal clinical training. All she had done was an apprenticeship with a doctor, and then she got on her horse and rode off to take care of these families. So when she encountered polio in the outback of Australia, she had no idea what the treatment for it was supposed to be. She'd never seen it before. So she just applied her practical knowledge to the disease. And the kids that she treated, none of those kids ended up being crippled. Long story short, Sister Kenny ended up establishing a whole new treatment regimen for polio that was in direct conflict with what doctors were doing with polio victims at that time. We're talking now in the 1930s and going into the 40s.
Would it be interesting, do you think, to our listeners to describe just briefly the different regimens?
Yeah, I think it's very instructive because the orthodox treatment involved taking these kids when they were acutely ill, and polio is an extremely painful disease and it causes a lot of muscle spasm, and they would take these kids and actually forcibly straighten them out into a neutral position. And this was so painful that very often they would have to do it under anesthesia. And these kids would be described as waking up screaming from pain. And they would be in these splints and braces. They would be strapped down to these contraptions. Well, and then they'd be put in bed and left there for months.
Well, let's say one more thing about that, which is from what you're saying, this is very much driven by the sense that doctors know best, doctors act on you.
Exactly. And that the patient is the passive recipient of their care. Sister Kenny turned all that on its head. She came out of the idea that people needed to heal themselves, that they needed to be in charge of their care, that the single most important thing to do at the onset was to relieve the pain. Once you relieve the pain, it was to get those extremities, those arms and legs functioning again. And she was very successful.
So not just acting from above on the people suffering, but enlisting them. The premise seems to be entirely different.
Completely different. It came out of a set of values of self-reliance, of self-knowledge, self-activation, of putting the patient at the center of the treatment.
Okay, that's all very interesting. And she was successful beyond in that some of her regimen, at least, became adopted. So we've got a couple of large questions then. What enabled her to come to different insights? You've already addressed that. But it's clear that her outsider status, coming from abroad and the lack of official training, partly helped her come to that. The second question would be why her procedure, why her regimen won out. But the third, really, given our conversation today, is what all this has to do with the phenomenon of medical populism.
Well, it became apparent very quickly that her methods were superior to the orthodox methods. She was able to demonstrate that. And families, for the first time in over a decade, actually had some sense of hope that their kids could recover from this very devastating disease. And so there was actually a movement that rose up behind her to support her and to take her part in what was a very fierce debate between her and the medical establishment that was tasked with researching polio and deciding how it would be treated. And this was primarily in the hands of the whole network of Eastern universities with their elite researchers. And they were very wedded to a notion of medical research that was conducted in the laboratory and was not correlated with clinical outcomes. Sister Kenny felt like medical research should also come to the bedside, and that whatever was figured out in the lab should be correlated with your clinical picture.
So the importance of lived experience. But why are we talking about Sister Kenny in as somehow an exemplar of all the alternative supposed approaches to COVID that you castigated earlier?
Because there was a similar kind of movement that rose up around her.
So a political movement.
A political movement. And it had many of the hallmarks of a right-wing medical populism. It was highly Christian. It had an anti-intellectual and anti-scientific kind of flavor to it. It was anti-Semitic and anti-communist. And it was described by at least one observer as having some cult-like characteristics. But this controversy then spilled into the media, into magazines and newspapers and radio talk shows and eventually to the TV. And then there was a feature film that was made of Sister Kenny that paints her as really this kind of saint when she wasn't. I should stop to say that she was a very flamboyant character. She was very large for a woman, and she had a good sense of humor, and she was a bit of a publicity hound, and she loved being the center of attention, and she, you know, was not all that dissimilar to a right-wing demagogue in the sense that she was constantly trying to stir up controversy.
So this is a very ambiguous character we're talking
very
about.
Very ambiguous character.
And part of the ambiguity goes back to a point you made earlier, which is these kinds of movements, quite separate from and even targeting establishment medicine, whatever it is, in whatever era, that they can make contributions too, that they're not simply negative. And that gets us back to our objection to the term medical populism, which treats the phenomenon as if it were simply an attack on expertise, and expertise is 100% triumphant.
Right.
Given that, where do we go from here? How do we understand then the ambiguity of what's being called medical populism? How do we relate to it?
I think the first thing that needs to happen is to understand the legitimate grievances that lie behind some of those populist uprisings in the context of public health emergencies. At the beginning of COVID, for example, there were many, many failures and missteps that were perpetrated by the so-called experts. For example, the CDC.
This is the Center for Disease Control.
Right.
Kind of our official watchdog.
Right.
Over health issues.
Right. They initially refused to use a COVID test that had been developed and put out there by the World Health Organization because they felt that they needed to develop their own. And then when they did, they created one that had a faulty reagent and it was useless. And long story short, testing in the U.S. was set back by several weeks because of hubris, because of the hubris of the CDC. So that was one problem. And then there were a whole series of mixed messages that came out, constantly changing. There was a lack of transparency. There was an ongoing politicization. The whole failure to very early suggest that masking was important was not because there was no scientific evidence. There was plenty of evidence that people should be masking. The CDC recommended against masking in those early weeks because they were worried there would be a run on surgical masks and healthcare workers wouldn't have them. So it was a political choice. It wasn't a public health choice.
I hadn't remembered that. So real missteps on the part of officials and real reasons then for resistance just to leaving everything in the hands of expertise.
Exactly. I think the credibility of the experts took a real hit during those early weeks and months. And it continued, partly because Trump politicized so much.
We've been talking about a really interesting phenomenon, again, historically, and we're seeing it play out in our own times. I don't know if you want to say anything more about our own times.
Well, I think I would like to end simply by saying that when these kinds of movements rise up, I think it's incumbent upon the medical scientific community to look beneath what's on the surface to see what the legitimate grievances are, that these movements can be a way of holding up a mirror to a system that is not necessarily transparent or providing service in the way that it should, or there may be a whole host of problems that underlie that rising up. And the other point, I think, is that you simply can't dismiss populist ideas without looking at them, taking them seriously. Now, I'm not saying that we should do studies on ivermectin, but I do want to point out that, for example, doulas, the use of women coaches when women are in childbirth, have been shown to remarkably improve outcomes. This is not something that originated within the medical scientific community. This is a practice that originated within traditional healing practices. There are ideas, there are practices that come out of alternative ways of thinking about health and disease that we need to pay attention to that may have considerable merit.
At the same time, as there are a lot of snake oil kinds of
absolutely
would-be solutions. Well, let's conclude on that note. All the household signs that say, in this household, we believe in medicine and science. That's true. That's a good yes. message, but it's a more nuanced message than people might realize.
There's a tension there between what we think of as modern scientific evidence-based medicine and ways of practicing, of thinking about health and disease that we need to not simply dismiss because they're unscientific, but rather take them seriously and adopt what we can in terms of their contributions.
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia Kohlberg. This is Norm Diamond. I'm going to turn the program back over to Patricia for a follow-up Well Read.
Coming to you loud and clear. I'd like to bring everyone's attention.
The musical clip you just heard is called The Healer by Erika Badu, who sings about hip-hop as healer, bigger than religion, bigger than the government. Before that, Norm Diamond and I discussed the ambiguities of so-called medical populism as it manifested during a long-ago polio epidemic and during the current COVID crisis. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. I'd like to turn now to a deeper dive into disinformation about COVID vaccines. Dr. Caitlin Jedalina is an epidemiologist and biostatistician who finds that COVID-19 disinformation is coordinated, effective, lucrative, and costs lives. Her article, called The Science and Business of COVID-19 Disinformation, was originally published on Dr. Jedalina's Substack newsletter called Your Local Epidemiologist, and republished on Portside on January 20, 2023. Here is an excerpt from that article, edited for length and clarity. Rumors around COVID-19 vaccines and death aren't random. Disinformation campaigns are deliberate, often orchestrated, and highly effective in confusing people enough to change behaviors, like not getting the COVID-19 vaccine. And it's a very lucrative business. Malicious rumors continue to be a massive challenge in public health, but there are things that can be done. Rumors, stigma, and conspiracy theories related to the COVID pandemic are everywhere. One study found that in the infancy of the pandemic in April 2020, they were present in 85 countries and in 25 different languages. The countries with the highest levels? India, followed by the US and China. Analyses have found that only 12 people, coined the disinformation dozen, are responsible for two-thirds of misleading claims, rumors, and lies about COVID-19 vaccines on social media. A scientific study published in Nature found that 1 in 4 anti-COVID-19 vaccine tweets originated from the so-called Children's Health Defense, which is controlled by one man, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Bots, or automated accounts on social media to spread online disinformation, are starting to be used for public health topics. During the pandemic, research found accounts that were linked to coronavirus information from less reliable sites were more likely to be bots. As Georgetown's Center for Security reported, amplification of disinformation campaigns will get worse with the rise of artificial intelligence and machine learning. Why do disinformation campaigns work so well? False information goes farther, faster, deeper, and more broadly than the truth. One study found false news was 6 times faster at spreading than the truth, reached far more people, and was more broadly diffused. Why does false news spread so quickly? There are specific tactics used to ensure that information goes viral. 1. Leveraging social media. Our information ecosystem is very different than it used to be because of social media. It's a huge part of how people get their news, and it's the greatest source of health information worldwide. Exploiting information gaps quickly. A lie can go around the world before the truth gets its pants on. It takes an order of magnitude more effort to refute rumors than to invent them. 3. Failing to provide context. Vaccine rumors are intentionally vague. Specifics are not narrowed down. Conditions may seem the same to an untrained person, but are entirely distinct. Different hypotheses are blended together, allowing proponents to shift from one to the other when the data doesn't turn out like they expected. 4. Kernel of truth. Almost all vaccine rumors have a kernel of truth, something that is true but then distorted, taken out of context, or exaggerated. For example, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System does say that more than 18,000 people have died after the vaccine. However, this does not prove anything about the contribution of the vaccine to those deaths. 5. Sowing doubts about scientific consensus. This was famously done in the 1960s from Big Tobacco, companies funding sham studies. Researchers found this tactic was intentionally used with vaccines during the pandemic. 6. Exaggerating partisan grievances. Harvard identified the most common narratives of COVID-19 disinformation were quote-unquote corrupt elites, quote-unquote freedom from siege, and quote-unquote health freedom. 7. Presenting fringe views as mainstream. This was dangerously on display when the BBC invited a prominent anti-vaxxer on TV to talk about statins. But the guest instead hijacked the conversation and pivoted to mRNA vaccines leading to death. Social media is a domain for manipulating beliefs and ideas. The danger is that it ultimately leads to real-world actions, such as not to vaccinate. The Kaiser Family Foundation found that between June 2021 and March 2022, 234,000 deaths could have been prevented with the primary series of vaccinations. Why would people intentionally push a rumor? It's simple: to turn a profit. Disinformation campaigns like COVID-19 vaccines turn out to be an incredibly lucrative business model. For example, Joseph Mercola uses health disinformation to promote the sale of supplements, books, and food. During the height of the pandemic, he promoted a new website designed to prevent or treat COVID-19 with alternative remedies. His business has a net worth of $100 million. What to do about disinformation? Treat it like the public health problem it is. Invest, surveil, prevent, and intervene. Integrate education into schools like Finland, which has started educating their youth about disinformation. Researchers have found that education about disinformation tactics makes people more likely to reject disinformation. The bottom line is that 12 people are responsible for 65% of disinformation about COVID-19 vaccines on social media. It's coordinated, effective, lucrative, and it costs lives. This is true during the pandemic, and it will be true for other public health problems. It's a public health and biosecurity threat, and we need to treat it like one. That was an excerpt from an article by Dr. Caitlin Gentilina entitled The Science and Business of COVID-19 Disinformation. Links to the full article and to Dr. Gentilina's website can be found on the Old Mole webpage for this show on kboo.fm. Next week on the Old Mole Fran Michelle, we'll continue our focus on the politics of the COVID crisis by examining what's behind the premature declaration that the COVID pandemic is over and the consequences of doing so. We're going to close our show this morning with a tribute to South African nurse and traditional healer Palesa Clementina Mofana Kendall Mofokeng. Palesa lived for a time in Portland with her adoptive mother, Kendall, before returning to South Africa to work as a licensed practical nurse and Sangoma, or traditional healer. She died of COVID in July of 2021. Palesa had not been able to get a COVID vaccination. In this segment, Desiree Helliger sets the context and speaks with Palesa's mother about the life and death of her daughter.
You just heard an excerpt from the Playing for Change version of Peter Gabriel's 1980 tribute to South African anti-apartheid freedom fighter Stephen Biko. On September 12, 1977, Biko was tortured to death by an apartheid regime of racial and economic separation that U.S.-based corporations actively profited from and that the U.S. government propped up for decades. On the other hand, for two decades, universities, labor unions, faith communities, civil society groups in the U.S. joined in the global anti-apartheid movement, which continues to inspire the Boycott, Sanctions, and Divestment, or BDS, movement in response to the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. The 1994 election of Nelson Mandela, the leader of the African National Congress, or ANC, as president, after decades of struggle, was heralded as the end of apartheid and the beginning of majority rule in South Africa. In July 2021, the limits of liberation in contemporary South Africa were brought home to some of us in the Portland social justice community with the COVID death of South African healer Palesa Clementina Mofana Kendall Mofokeng on July 18th. The fact that economic conditions for the vast majority of Black people in post-apartheid South Africa remain unchanged highlights a long-standing critical debate between the ANC and the Black Consciousness Movement, of which Biko was a primary intellectual architect. While the ANC defined apartheid in strictly racial terms, as Hedor Eid and Andy Clarno, among others, have noted, quote, Black radicals insisted that the struggle should simultaneously confront the state and the racist capitalist system. Unless racism and capitalism were confronted together, they predicted post-apartheid South Africa would remain divided and unequal, unquote. In the wake of Palesa's death, I spoke with her adoptive mother, who is white, and who echoed in many ways the critiques of the Black Consciousness Movement. If you want to get a sense of the kind of poverty that Palesa was born into, you might check out the Playing for Change video of Biko. The video is haunting and beautiful. Peter Gabriel, Angelique Kidjo, and Yo-Yo Ma perform at least virtually alongside a global ensemble of musicians, singers, and dancers that ranges from Cape Town, South Africa, to Mumbai, to L.A. Taiko drummers in Little Tokyo, L.A. perform alongside drummers and dancers from the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe in Nevada. Collectively, they pay tribute to Biko and to the living promise of decolonizing struggles that are inherently and necessarily anti-capitalist, given that the history of capitalism is inextricably rooted in colonial and neocolonial violence. The video opens with the all-black Cape Town ensemble singing amid the rubble of an impoverished informal settlement in Guguletu, which, as Kendall noted, looked very much like the settlement where she first encountered Palesa. Here are excerpts from my 2021 interview with Kendall. Palesa's adoptive mother, known by the single name Kendall, is a well-loved member of the Portland activist community. A perennial presence at Portland Street Actions as a photographer and as an organizer with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, along with any other number of local groups. With a PhD in theater, Kendall was a professor at Smith College before they took a Fulbright to Lesotho before moving to South Africa, where their life and Palesa's were inextricably woven together.
They met in 1992, the year Palesa turned 7, and 4 years after Nelson Mandela was released after nearly 30 years in prison. Business as usual for Palesa's mother, without access to land or other means of production, meant being driven to the brink as an impoverished sex worker with 7 children and no access to reproductive or any other kind of health care. Palesa would go on to become a healer. Amid riots spurred by hunger and desperation exacerbated by the COVID lockdown and following the arrest of former President Jacob Zuma, Palesa died on July 18th in South Africa, leaving behind 2 children, one 15 and the other just days short of their first birthday. Kendall, speaking about Palesa.
She was a large, joyful, loud spirit. She was very extroverted and loved to be with people and to connect. And she just was a walking party. She was joy. She was a loud, joyful, huge presence in the world. When she walked in, everybody knew she had walked into the room. But she was born to an impoverished alcoholic sex worker who did not want her. She became a kind of waif. So when I went to Lesotho in 1992 as a Fulbright scholar, I went into the village to start meeting the people, and I noticed this little girl who was always on the margins. And I asked about her, and people said, oh, she's trouble. Don't ask. But then she came to me. She took my hand. She looked into my face, and she just grabbed hold and held on. The first year that I was there, I started sending her to school because she had never been to school. I bought her underwear and clothing and shoes. And I did that for a number of children. It wasn't just her, because for what an American would spend for lunch, you can send a child to school for a year. So of course I did that. But the second year I was there, she developed a very high fever and she became unconscious. And her actual birth mother brought her to my door and said, you bury this one. God wants her to die. So, of course, I took her to the hospital. She had typhoid. They treated her. And when I got her out of the hospital, her mother, she said, I'm not taking her back. And Palesa fell on the ground crying, sobbing. And I felt that rejection by her mother so powerfully that I just took her to my house. And I did a lot of work to set her up in a boarding school. And I thought, okay, I'll just pay and I'll go back to America and I'll send money. But during the second year that I was there, when she came home for Easter vacation, she freed a child who had been used for sex, an 8-year-old child who was tied to a bed by her leg. Palesa, being deeply empathetic, cut her loose, brought her to me and said, you take care of her too. So again, I did all I could do with the social work people, and there was no space in an orphanage. I finally put the second one in the same boarding school. And after a few months, the nuns told me she's going to die. The little one is so traumatized by what her life has been. So I thought, well, what the hell have I got to do with my life that matters more than this? So I took her and I started procedures to adopt her. And then I thought, well, why not Palesa too? So, well, she had a little sister who she was very bonded with, who she carried on her back. And I said, what about her? And her mother said, I'm keeping her. She's my baby. So I took Bellessa, and I feared there would be a problem because of the bond she had with her biological sister. But we lived for the next 4 years in South Africa. And those were the 4 years of Nelson Mandela's term as president. He actually had 5 years, but I stayed for four of them. I stayed from 92 to 99. That was when I lived in Southern Africa. And in 95, I cannot tell you how excited everybody was. It was the beginning of the new South Africa. It was the end of despair. It was the beginning of what we thought would be equality and was not, sadly. Neocolonialism took over. There became a governing ruling class of wealthy Black, Indian, and white people all.
So a kind of multiracial capitalism.
Yeah. Yes. And they just repeated the horrible injustices. I don't blame Mandela for this, although he did let the white people off very easily, which is why they made him such a hero. He let all the white people keep their wealth because they just don't get it. White people were entitled to free education from kindergarten through college in schools that had Olympic-sized swimming pools and every possible technological innovation, computers, smart boards, everything. And Black children went to school, if at all, they had to pay, and they went to little shack things with no blackboards and no... The inequality was unimaginable to people in America. I mean, we have horrible, horrible inequality, but this was that on steroids. So she was coming from that kind of background of hunger and despair, and within her class and caste, she was at the bottom because she was an unwanted female child. And yet she had this huge spirit and this beautiful soul and great empathy. I mean, who else would cut another child loose and bring her? How she died. Okay, so I brought her to America with me in 99. She did not like America. It was so shocking to her that people had to make appointments to talk to each other, that people didn't walk in the streets, that they got into cars to get from place to place. The whole individualistic culture of America to her was just anathema. And she missed her little sister horribly. And she dreamed about her little sister. She heard voices of her little sister calling her. So when she was 18 and grown, she chose to go back. And I supported her after she went back. She couldn't find jobs. Finally, she decided she wanted to be a nurse. So I sent her to school. She became what we would call a licensed vocational nurse or a practical nurse. But she made it all the way through the program, and she was so proud. She was so proud of her uniform and being a nurse and being a healer. And she also trained as a traditional healer. So she was a Sangoma as well as a Western healer. But when COVID came, first she got TB from her patients and her lungs were damaged. Then she got COVID and she got it in June and she recovered, but she was using breathing equipment. And then she got it again in July and she could hardly breathe. She sent me voice messages and there was a whistle in her chest and you could hear that every breath was labored. So when the Zuma riot started on July 8th, people started burning down grocery stores.
And we're talking about the former president, Jacob Zuma.
Incredibly corrupt. And because of his corruption, he was asked by his party to step down. And then he was jailed on July 8th. When those riots started by the Zuma people, many other desperately hungry, angry people who have just been sitting with the disappointment of the new South Africa for so many years were furious. And they saw some of the Zuma people looting the grocery stores. And so they thought, well, if they're going to loot the grocery stores, I'm not going to have any food. I better go. So gradually this rolling movement happened of the people who were hungry, who went into the grocery stores, looted them, and then set them on fire. And if you can imagine hardly being able to breathe in a freezing cold winter, when the toxic smoke from the fires entered her little shack where she lived, she could no longer breathe. And she fought for days. She fought to be able to breathe because she had a baby who was just about to be one, and she'd bought her some beautiful first year birthday presents she wanted to present to her. But the smoke, there was no food. Nobody could get food from the 11th of July till after the 18th when she died. There was no food, there was no medicine, and there was this hideous choking smoke, which we know about from the fires last year, that just poisonous smoke. She wanted a vaccine, but she couldn't get it, even though she was a health worker. Only 3% of the people in her country have vaccines. Well, you know who those are. Those are the people with money. So she died. We did have a GoFundMe. It raised $20,000, which is wonderful. This will enable Palesa's biological sister to take care of the children and herself and her children. But nothing will ever, ever, ever mitigate that incredible loss. Those children had a mother who was a giant. She was diagnosed with a lung infection rather than COVID. And other friends I have in South Africa says, yes, that's what they're calling COVID because they don't want the COVID numbers to be high. The real culprit is economic inequality, which is worse in South Africa now than it was before Mandela was elected. And we see it everywhere. You know that it's in Portland. It's the people having to live in the street because of the money hoarding that's going on from the millionaires and the billionaires and the trillionaires. And it is that capitalistic poison that has wrecked the climate and is wrecking the lives of millions of people all over the world. And South Africa is at the cutting edge of that. So it's the poison of capitalism that killed her.
That was the voice of Portland Buddhist Peace Fellowship organizer and photographer Kendall. And we've been speaking about her daughter, Palesa Clementina Mofana Kendall Mofokeng, a traditional healer and healthcare worker who died in South Africa in July. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Omo Variety Hour. That was Desiree Helliger speaking with Kendall, the adoptive mother of Palesa Mofokeng, who died a wholly preventable death of COVID in South Africa in 2021. That's a wrap for our show today. Thanks to Moles, Norm Diamond, and Desiree Helliger for their contributions, and to our guest today, Kendall. Our gratitude goes out as well to the staff at KABU who show up every day to keep community radio alive in Portland. Join us again next Monday morning for more reviews and reviews from the ground up. Jan Hockham will speak with radical historian Paul Buell about the left in Hollywood. Bill Resnick will dive into the anti-democratic threats in our own hometown and the resistance to those threats. And Fran Michel will look behind the premature declarations that the COVID pandemic is over. Until then, stay safe and stay active. I'm going to go out with one last song about the healing powers of music. Despite being a hard-boiled believer in science, I do believe that music can help us heal by bringing us hope, joy, validation, and understanding, none of which are trivial when it comes to preserving our health and well-being. This song is called Soul Vaccination from Tower of Power. Everybody get in line. Soul vaccination.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start